We are moving into high gear as the primary election approaches. More candidates sign-waving on the streets and more campaign literature and broadcast ads circulating. On The Longview today, our political analyst Neil Milner joins us to talk about the pathology of elections. Good morning, Neil.
Hi.
You know, when I think of pathology, I think of disease. Are you saying our elections are sick or ailing?
Well, I didn't pick the metaphor, but I think it's a pretty good one. This is a piece that's going to be coming out in the Journal of Election Law by a man named Richard Hassan, who's a election law specialist. He's at the University of California, Irvine. And he says, if you look at what the pandemic is doing to the possibility of elections, you see that what we really have in this country is, in our voting system, three pathologies. That is, three things that are basically wrong. And the first one is that the elections are not really administered at a national level at all. Congress has a few things to say about elections. The Constitution has a couple of things to say about setting the date. But essentially, elections are administered and decisions are made by approximately 10,000 jurisdictions in the country. So if you have a national pandemic that crosses all of those jurisdictions, you don't have one kind of decision. So the first problem is that where you live can very much determine the obstacles that you're going to face legally, politically, in order to vote. The second one is, and it really feeds into the first one, the second one is that the right to vote, who gets to vote, who doesn't, how do you administer elections, what can you change and what can't you change because of the pandemic, has become totally polarized and politicized. So that what you have essentially is this. You have Republicans who really want to worry about suppressing the vote and, in fact, make an argument without evidence, the president does this, that mail ballots have are fraudulent, that they have the opportunity for fraud. There's no evidence of that. Democrats are much more willing to open up the franchise. But and the courts have taken very different opinions on this. But within all of this, that is, you're throwing it to the courts to make a decision. The courts are polarized like everybody else. The U.S. Supreme Court just made the first really national decision about what you can do to adjust your election procedures late on because of the pandemic virus. They ruled against Wisconsin being able to do the things that it wanted to do. And the opinion, the majority of opinion, never even mentions the pandemic. It's as if things just go on. The dissent said, hey, there's a pandemic here. You got to open it up. So that's really the second thing, and related to that is that the standards that courts use to decide in favor of a voter or against a voter are pretty vague and get used in different ways. The third thing, and this is really fundamental, and it may surprise some people, the Constitution's protection of voting is very weak. There is not in the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, any affirmative statement of the right to vote. You have statements that prohibit certain limitations on the right. You use the Due Process Clause. So you have a constitutional system that is pretty weak, that doesn't really do very much, that doesn't really set national standards that are very helpful in this situation. And so you're sort of out there with not very many protections. What that means is that what Professor Hassan says is the thing that haunted him in the first place, and that is the pictures on April 7th of a lot of African Americans in Wisconsin standing in line with masks on and heavy winter clothes, because early April in Wisconsin it's still pretty cold, standing in line to vote. Now, we know a couple of things about that. One, a fairly trivial one, it was my high school that they show the pictures of nationally, the one I went to many years ago.
Wow.
I know. The second thing is that there were some coronavirus cases from that. That case, that whole situation was about the Republicans fighting the governor's attempt to change the vote. So we haven't even talked about how you administer mail-in ballot, which we might want to do now. But those are the fundamental, that's the fundamental context. Notice nothing about Russian interference, nothing about those kind of more spectacular things that could happen. This is everyday voting administration life.
Well, and it is scary, you know, with the threat of COVID these days affecting, you know, what happens at the polls, because a lot of our poll volunteers are seniors and more susceptible. And yep. Here in Hawaii, we, you know, decided what, a year or more ago, that we were going to do mail-in ballots, and lots of discussion around, you know, whether we're ready for that and whether we've done all the homework.
Well, we're fortunate in one way. It may be it's luck. It's also a decision made over time that we made this decision to have mail-in ballots relatively early before the pandemic, so that there was a head start on getting the things ready for getting the elections ready for that. You have in other states, for example, some states you have to get permission to vote absentee. There are very few states that have all mail-in ballots, I think five. Some states don't even let you vote absentee unless you get permission. So there's all kinds of stuff going on about trying to change things at the last minute with a lot of political resistance. Here we have the system at least initially in place. How it's going to work, we don't know. Remember, you can't vote. You really have to vote by mail. There's, you know, a couple of exceptions. How likely it is to work depends on a number of things. One of which, it depends on how effective how much the pandemic affects people's even interest to vote. But putting that aside, it affects the likelihood of people voting for other reasons. What makes mail-in ballots work is an educational process, especially the first time, that explains them to people and tells them what to do. There have been some critics of how much the Office of Elections has done in that regard. We'll see. But at least we don't have this last-minute attempt, I mean, literally last-minute in some of the primaries in other states, to adopt a absentee ballot system, because most people have been voting, not most, a substantial number of people have been voting absentee here before, so they know what to do. And so that at least is taken care of. But the rest of it is you're still trying a new process with an election bureaucracy that has not really done this before. And you have to rely on things like people understanding postmarks and when you have to get the ballot in order for it to be counted.
Right. And the State Office of Elections is, you know, starting its campaign this week to kind of educate voters as to how to do it right and get it in so it can be counted.
That's right. Now, again, you know, there's a whole kind of literature on how you influence people. I'm really not in a position to judge how well they're doing. But you're starting to see stuff coming out right now. Now, you got to remember one other thing. I think that it's important. The people who say that mail-in ballots increase turnout under normal circumstances, there are two counters to that, one of which is that it doesn't increase turnout too much. The other is that there are other reasons that the assumption is that mail-in balloting is easier than voting in person. There are two things about that assumption. Maybe it is and maybe it isn't, not if you're unfamiliar with mail-in. The other thing is there are lots of reasons why people don't vote, which have nothing to do with the obstacles they face. They're not interested. They don't think it pays. They don't think it's of any use. But the fundamental thing is we're trying a new system. The new system is at least in place. It's not something they had to drop and create in an emergency and get the courts involved. We'll see how it works.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Neil.
Sure. Take care.
That was Neil Milner, retired professor of political science and our contributing editor of our segment, The Long View.